The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to a special presentation of An Hour with Alice Walker. Novelist Alice Walker is known for her depictions of black women struggling for sexual and racial equality who emerge as strong, creative individuals. In 1970, Walker published her first novel, The Third Life of Grange Copeland, about the ravages of racism on a black sharecropping family. She is best known for her 1982 novel, The Color Purple. The novel garnered the American Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize in 1983, and in 1985 was made into a movie by Steven Spielberg. In her novel Meridian, she explored a woman's successful efforts to find her place in the civil rights movement. In the 1992 novel Possessing the Secret of Joy, a young woman undergoes the African tradition of female circumcision. Her most recent book is Anything We Love Can Be Saved. Walker has published several volumes of poetry, collections of short stories, as well as books of essays on women's issues. This program was made possible by the William Penn Foundation and was recorded in front of a live audience at the Pennsylvania Convention Center as part of the Free Library of Philadelphia's Rebuilding the Future series.
I'm really seriously happy to be here. I had a difficult time getting out of California because we're having such rainy weather. And the traffic was so bad that I thought about getting out and walking, you know, that kind of traffic. But I finally made it, and it's really wonderful because what you have is what we've been longing for. You have warmth. You have warmth and you have dry. And we've been aching for warmth and dry. So really enjoy it. It's really wonderful to have. And then when your drought comes on, think about how great it will be to have rain. I always feel at home when there's a drought, and we've had some terrible droughts. I always get so dry, I can really feel it in myself, in every cell. And it becomes really difficult to write. It becomes difficult to think about anything but moisture. I want to share with you some poems and some essays from my last book, which is called Anything We Love Can Be Saved, A Writer's Activism. But I want to start by reading you a poem that, in effect, gives you a bouquet of sunflowers, just to honor the fact that you have sun and to cheer myself up because I've planted sunflowers, planted seeds, and they probably are waiting for some sun to show them what they're supposed to do. If there was any justice in the world, I'd own Van Gogh's Starry Night. Not the tall linear one I have always coveted, but the wide horizontal one on which the paint is desperate praise. It would hang over the headboard of my bed, so that every night before falling asleep I could look at it, and then above it, through the skylight at the heavens. If there was any justice in the world, I could have saved up for it and bought it for the cost of a fancy dress or a modest house. Vincent would have wanted me to have it. Of this I have no doubt. How he would smile to see how every night I journeyed through the cosmos on the wings of his brush, my dreadlocks connecting canvas to moon. He probably would have given me the painting if we had been neighbors, friends, or barroom aficionados, and I had offered him watermelon or homemade wine. If there was any justice in the world, I'd also have that last painting he did of the reaper and the wide field of crows. I'd have the sunflowers, all of them, of course. Whoever has the poor taste to hoard them could keep the ugly portraits of Madame Hoose's and Dr. Whatz's. But there are a couple of garden scenes I would also take. Vincent, knowing I value flowers in orderly disarray, would have wanted them to be mine. If we had met in the presence of these paintings, he couldn't have missed the wonder, the reverence, the stark recognition of shared life in my eyes. My delight in him, spirit, eye, and hand. As the world rushes madly to its end, and one imagines the starry night, lonely as Vincent himself in its vault, bursting suddenly into flame like a bit of star or a bit of rubbish. And the same tired assassins whose blindness drove him insane, seeking at last to destroy all the beauty beyond the vault that he labored so to make them see, and seeing, save. When you have a life of activism, sometimes it's difficult to know. People always say, well, why are you an activist and when did it start? And I was telling a story earlier this evening about how when I was growing up in Georgia, I could not go to the public library because I wasn't permitted there, and how this set up this feeling in me of fear of libraries. And so even today, it's very difficult for me to be in a library without a great feeling of self-consciousness. So I think that those things set up a feeling of changing this when you're big enough. It's very difficult to be 6 and 7 years old and able to grasp in any sense what is happening when someone tells you, no, you cannot come in here, you cannot have a book. But I also go very far back, and I've decided to read you a little bit from the acknowledgments to this book on activism, because I think some of you may have ancestors who are similar to this woman in terms of longevity. And if you have, I would like to know. The first person I must thank for my belief in activism is my great-great-great-grandmother, May Poole. She lived enslaved in the North American South throughout the 19th century, dying at the age of 125 when my father was a boy of 11. Does anybody have anybody that old? Not that you know of. Maybe you'll be the first. So strong was her spirit, and so clearly did I reflect some of it, that the elderly white woman to whom she'd been given as a wedding gift over 3/4 of a century before recognized me as her descendant from an article and photograph in the local newspaper. When I went to visit this aged woman and her husband in a nursing home before their deaths, she gave me the only photograph of May Poole in existence. In it, she is undeniably old, in her 90s, according to the elderly couple, although I think she was probably much older, and leaning on a stick. But in her look, I can still see the attitude and courage that made it possible for her to attend the funerals of almost everyone who'd ever owned her. Imagine what that must have felt like. And in a way, we can never really know. We can guess, but we can never really know, because we don't know the heart. I thank my mother for mothering all the children within her reach who needed it, and especially for attempting to instill spiritual values, which she did by holding Bible studies with the neighborhood children in her living room. I could see, because she believed it, and that every child is precious, and each one must be sheltered, instructed in whatever broadens his or her appreciation of life, and physically fed without question. Nor does she discriminate on the basis of size, color, shape of head, or degree of intelligence. She never heard of Marx, not even from me, yet she lived the axiom from each according to his or her abilities, to each according to his or her needs, and proved that Christ was right when he said, "Suffer little children to come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven." For her activity on behalf of children and the community resulted in making my mother a very happy, light-filled woman. She spent many years in heaven, long before she died. This was daily, simply amazing to see. I thank my father for his wonderful sense of humor, which effortlessly undermined the racist nonsense that passed for white supremacist wisdom while I was growing up. He would have shared a laugh with Zora Neale Hurston, who said, when stopped for going through a red light in the segregated South, "Well, I saw all the white people going on the green, so I thought the red must be for me." He too had a story for every occasion and taught me it is possible for the word to become sharper than the sword. And then I thank a number of other people, including Howard Zinn, Staunton Lind, Che Guevara, Fidel Castro, Rosa Parks, Tilly Olson, Marion Wright Edelman, my former husband Mel Leventhal, all of these people who somehow come together as a kind of band of angels in my life. And each has taught me something really profound and wonderful about changing things that are hurtful. You know, things can be hurtful, and it's beyond the word oppression. It goes right to the heart of hurt, being wounded by injustice. And these are all people who taught me a lot. I start this book with an essay that's called "The Only Reason You Want to Go to Heaven Is That You've Been Driven Out of Your Mind." Because unlike my parents, who were colonized spiritually and who were Christians, but in that way that, you know, they definitely had to be, there was no alternative that they could imagine, I grew up to be someone very different. And even as a child, the out-of-doors held my attention much more securely than whatever was going on in the pulpit. So I was thinking about all of the things that I was learning in church and questioning them deeply, and realizing that for me, anything that denied my pagan roots, you know, the heathen roots, anything that denied that was something that really could not ultimately embrace all that I am. And so this first section is about that. And I also talk about and demonstrate how the Bible, as a document, is very, it has been used to colonize people all over the world. And I end by writing this part here. "It is fatal to love a God who does not love you, a God specifically created to comfort, lead, advise, strengthen, and enlarge the tribal borders of someone else. We have been beggars at the table of a religion that sanctioned our destruction, our own religions denied, forgotten, our own ancestral connections to all creation, something of which we are ashamed. I maintain that we are empty, lonely, without our pagan heathen ancestors, that we must lively them up within ourselves and begin to see them as whole and necessary and correct. Their earth-centered, female-reverencing religions like their architecture, agriculture, and music, suited perfectly to the lives they led and lead those few who are left today. I furthermore believe that our sense of the Jesus we've been brought up to adore must be expanded to include the wizard and the dancer, and that when this is done, it becomes clear that he coexists quite easily with pagan indigenous peoples. Indeed, it was because the teachings of Jesus were already familiar to many of our ancestors, especially in the New World. They already practiced the love and sharing that he preached, that the Christian church was able to make as many genuine converts to the Christian religion as it did. All people deserve to worship a God who also worships them, a God that made them and likes them. That is why nature, Mother Earth, is such a good choice. Never will nature require that you cut off some part of your body to please it. Never will Mother Earth find anything wrong with your natural way. She made it, and she made it however it is, so that you will be more comfortable as part of her creation rather than less. Everyone deserves a God who adores our freedom. Nature would never advise us to do anything but be ourselves. Mother Earth will do all that she can to support our choices, whatever they are, for they are of her, and inherent in our creation is her trust. We are born knowing how to worship, just as we are born knowing how to laugh. This is because sometimes we believe, because we are taught that we have to worship in a certain way, that somehow you don't know that if you see something that is awesome, that it is quite natural to fall to your knees. What is the result of decolonizing the spirit? It is as if one truly does possess a third eye, and this eye opens. One begins to see the world from one's own point of view, to interact with it out of one's own conscience and heart, one's own pagan earth spirit. We begin to flow again with and into the universe. And out of this flowing comes the natural activism of wanting to survive, to be happy, to enjoy one another and life, and to laugh. We begin to distinguish between the need singly to throw rocks at whatever is oppressing us and the creative joy that arises when we bring our collective stones of resistance against injustice together. We begin to see that we must be loved very much by whatever creation is to find ourselves on this wonderful earth. We begin to recognize our sweet, generously appointed place in the makeup of the cosmos. We begin to feel glad and grateful to be not in heaven, but here. Of course, this kind of thinking would have been very hard for my parents. In fact, I think they would not have been able to endure it, because they had been convinced that there was really nothing else, that the ancestry that they had, which was old European, old African, and old Native American, that that ancestry had something fatally flawed about it, that in fact they were born heathens, black, female, wrong. And sometimes I regret that my parents are not alive so that we could have these discussions. But I think it's worth having them. I think it is worth having them with whoever we interact with. Because until we decolonize the spirit, there is no possibility of actually loving our whole selves. So I want to read you now from an essay. Someone was asking me earlier whether I was still involved in the struggle against female genital mutilation. And I was saying that I was, but that when I started writing about it, I decided that I would give myself 5 years and of researching and writing and traveling. And I wrote Possessing the Secret of Joy. And then because I realized that the 100 million women and girls who are affected, most of them would never be able to read that book, I collaborated with a filmmaker to make a film about this subject. And we traveled to Africa, and we traveled all over, both making the film and then taking it around to people so that they could see it and so that there could be discussions. And in the beginning, of course, nobody believed that this was even happening. I remember I live in a little town in Northern California, and the editor of the newspaper, when he heard about what I was doing, said that, well, you know, Alice is very much like Margaret Mead, who went to New Guinea and was asking the people, you know, about their sex life, and they just told her any old thing. because it is very difficult, even now that we all have heard and we all have some idea of what this is, it's still a very difficult thing to feel and to know is happening to children, to women. And I remember when I first started going around talking about it, lecturing about it, and especially reading from this novel, almost everywhere I went, women would faint. They would just drop. At least one woman in the audience, because it was felt as such an assault on the collective female physical being. So I want to just read you a little, tell you a little bit about what has been happening. And fortunately, what has been happening is that there is now a movement in Africa itself and in, so I hope, in the Middle East. I don't have many contacts there. A law has been passed in this country, of course, making it a felony to mutilate children. And other good things. I mean, just awareness has become much more, clear upon it. But a couple of years ago, I went to a conference in Bolgatanga, northern Ghana. And I'm going to read you a little about that, because what was so wonderful was that not only were we in, you know, the sort of the heart of Africa, talking to people, a lot of women, but there were a lot of African men, and this was the first time that this had been the case, because for during the first part of, you know, my work on this issue, the men would almost inevitably say they had no idea that, you know, they didn't know a thing about it. And this was so maddening, because then you would look at them and you would say, but you're sleeping with these women, you know? I mean, how can you not know? And you know, things like that. So at this conference, there are all these African men, and they were all remarkably clear, committed. And I began to have a real lightening of spirit, because it is a very heavy burden to think that you are trying to change something that really means health for the people, and they are in such denial that they just won't hear it. And the person that I most loved was this man whose name is Samuel Zan, and I call him Zan. And his nickname for me is Peaceful Woman. So he's telling us this story. A brother died before me being born, he tells the gathering. My own birth was long, very complicated. It went on for 3 days. My mother suffered a lot and was never again really well. An odd sound came from her uterus from the day of my birth. Her labor was so agonizing that her cries attracted the whole village. It was a major ordeal. So much so that I was named to memorialize the horrible nature of the event. My tribal name means, you have all seen. And by that he means the complications caused by the practice of female genital mutilation. Implicit is the question, what are you going to do about it? From what Zan is telling us, it sounds as though his mother was not only clitorally excised, but infibulated, stitched shut as well. This would mean an impossibly painful labor unless someone was there to properly open her up. Apparently no one was. He retells this story to the camera while sitting under a mammoth tree outside the building where the workshop is held. I am asking questions. Pratibha, my friend, the filmmaker, is filming. In less than 3 days, we have bonded. I feel I have known Zan all my life and for many lifetimes before. I lean my head against his shoulder when he stops for breath. His lanky body relaxes in a sigh as he leans closer to my side. We should probably never meet again, but there's definitely a forever feeling about the moment. Alice, he says after a long silence, do you know what I believe? I believe that if the women of the world were comfortable, this would be a comfortable world. What do you think? I was so happy to hear that, you know. For 2 days, we listened to testimonies of adults who were overpowered as children and irreparably wounded. I noticed that for some of the women speaking, it is as if a dam has burst. They tell their stories over and over with the same stunned amazement that there is a circle of faces mirroring them, that they are being heard, that all of us have wounds of one kind or another to share, and that somehow making sense of our wounds transforms them. As with the scars on Zan's face, I'm referring here to the fact that one of the reasons, other than the ordeal of his own birth, that Zan became active in this campaign is that when he was a little boy, he was basically kidnapped and he had the tribal markings put on his face so that today he has tribal markings. And there again, there's a whole world of denial about what is actually going on, you know, that there are people who think that, you know, even though you're 4 years old, you elect to have this done, or that it has real, you know, heavy-duty significance today. And he is saying with great courage that this is not so, that maybe at one time when Africans were kidnapped and sold into slavery and people could tell their tribespeople by marking them in this way. I mean, this is no longer what is happening now. And so it is something that should be abolished. And in fact, he talks about how his children, his little boys, have a great fear that this will be done to them and how he has to work really hard to make sure they don't have this aching anxiety about it all the time. As with the scars on Zan's face, as each woman shares very private memories of a fateful day in childhood during which she was changed forever, I am overwhelmingly aware of triumphant grace and naked loveliness. One of the more regal women telling her story is Madame Ba, a French-speaking Mali. Tall and stately, a magistrate in her native Bamako, each day she is dressed more elegantly than the last. Her story, it turns out, is not about her own mutilation, but about that of her 5 daughters. On the very first day we met, all of us, in the dusty garden of a guest house on the outskirts of Tamale, as we waited for our ride to Bolgatanga, she sat across from me and through Yidu, a bilingual male FGM abolitionist from Togo, told what happened. Her children had been mutilated against her will and theirs while their mother was away. 5, I asked incredulously, thinking the number a mistranslation. She repeats it, 5. Her eyes express sadness, shame, and a terrible guilt. It is the family, she explains. Neither she nor her husband wanted their daughters circumcised, but they were helpless before the combined might of their extended clan. Her daughter's aunts had the children mutilated and presented them to her, harm already done on her return home. Hannah from Sierra Leone tells a similar tale. As a small, trusting child, she was cajoled into accepting a ride on an older woman's back, then dumped into the restraining arms of many women who held her down as her clitoris was cut away. As she speaks, she relives the pain of the child she was. The adult woman disappears in the recovered terror of the child. I think of the 100 million or so stories still to be told, mirrored, heard. I can only hope the arms of the world will prove wide enough to embrace them all. But that we at the gathering embrace each other is clear from the beginning. Florence, just met, agrees to watch my bag as I search for a restroom in the Accra airport. And I, worried that she might not have eaten breakfast and that there might not be food on the plane, bring her a sandwich. The angriest woman at the gathering is also one of the youngest. She's the only one with a child, an infant boy, whom she breastfeeds while listening intently to what everyone says. Still holding her sleeping child, she rises to address us. The story she tells is of a young girl who refused to be circumcised, whose parents beat her and threw her out of the house, ending any and all support. She could no longer live at home, eat food at home, or wear clothing bought by her parents. She had to drop out of school because her school fees were no longer paid. She was forced to live with whoever took her in. What, she now asks us, do we think should be done to such parents? Her pain and rage are palpable. There are many attempts to answer her, none of them satisfactory. The house, ending any and all support. She could no longer live at home, eat food at home, or wear clothing bought by her parents. She had to drop out of school because her school fees were no longer paid. She was forced to live with whoever took her in. What, she now asks us, do we think should be done to such parents? Her pain and rage are palpable. There are many attempts to answer her, none of them satisfactory. Her blunt, courageous anger makes me think of Sojourner Truth baring her breasts to the jeers of white men at a 19th century women's rights convention. It is she and her sisters, I feel, who will move the struggle against FGM ever forward. And then I continue with a description of what it felt like in that little town to be sitting there with all these women, and probably all of them mutilated except for myself and Pratibha, who is a British Indian filmmaker. We were facing a bank of the people who were going to make decisions, and they were all men, every single one. And there was just this feeling, you know, of being up against something so monumental and so powerful and so, at the time I thought, possibly really unfeeling. And yet a really great thing happened, because then these men started to speak. And it turned out that they had very strong feelings against this practice. In fact, one of them said, let me just see. In the center of the long table is the major chief of the northern region of Ghana. He is a large man, forthright and jovial, dressed half in Ghanaian, half in Western clothes. He jokes easily with Veronica, acting mistress of ceremonies. They apparently grew up in the same village and went to school together. He evokes laughter and applause when he bluntly asks, "If God in his goodness gave woman a clitoris, who are we to take it away?" This was one of the first openly direct comments by an African man on this issue that I'd ever heard. And this is after working on this for years. He also calls circumcisers butchers and says they should all be put in jail. Next, a judge from the High Court painstakingly explains why the Ghanaian Constitution does not guarantee the right to circumcise children, as some have apparently claimed, even though it emphasizes the need to uphold cultural traditions. Since the Constitution stresses that the cultural traditions to be upheld must be, quote, enjoyed, any ritual that causes pain is by its nature left out. He is followed by a government minister who calls the practice of FGM dangerous, evil, and a blight on the conscience of Africa. It is a strong panel, conscientious and clear. I feel relieved, though I personally believe it is retraining for gainful employment that the mostly female circumcisers need, not imprisonment. Pratibha looks over at me from where she's panning the audience. It means a lot to us to hear strong words against FGM from African men. Because frankly, without the help of African men, there is no chance of changing this. So, I end this by saying, like Zan, I believe that the women of the world, if the women of the world were comfortable, so would the world be. In fact, I know this in my bones. Out of a woman's security, which always means free agency in society, sexual and spiritual autonomy, as well as the well-being of her children and the sanctity of her home, comes ultimate security for the world. Archaeological findings and ruins of matristic, pre-patriarchal societies bear this out. Evidence shows that for thousands of years, before male domination of Earth, women headed vibrant cultures that traded, reasoned, and celebrated with each other without the need to erect forts or walls. Certainly, the peacefulness Zan identified in me, a hard-won, not-every-minute-present peacefulness, to be sure, springs from my utter lack of interest in maiming, starving, killing, conquering, or otherwise inflicting humiliation and suffering on anyone or anything. We will end the practice of female genital mutilation and that of the facial scarring of children as well, because there are countless others in the world who also lack the impulse to harm and who share instead the desire to cherish and make whole. It will be a long struggle, waged neither with weapons nor words of blame, but rather with the understanding, patience, and commitment of a few thousand peaceful women and men like Zan, who deeply respect women and love children, who are, after all, the ultimate foundation of a human future. How are you doing? Are you okay? You know, the issues that are here for us, whichever generation we are, and all the generations I think are represented here, a lot of them, these issues are all really hard. They're really hard. And I think the only thing that makes them bearable is just that you begin somewhere. You begin somewhere. I remember when I first started thinking about this, I learned about female genital mutilation when I was a student. I guess I must have been 20 or so, and I was in Kenya helping to build a school. And they were talking about this thing, and I had no idea. I had no way of knowing what they could possibly mean. And it took me until, you know, a decade ago to really decide that I could start on this. But having started, it is truly gratifying to see, you know, that it has a life of its own, that ending pain has a life of its own. I went back to my old school in Atlanta, and they invited me to address the commencement class. And I wanted to give them the best that I could, and I decided that possibly the best that I could give them would be poems that I had written many years earlier, and all of them at periods of deep teaching, because you know, the periods that seem the hardest to bear are always the ones that have the deep teaching. And the trick is to just outlive them. And I, and in fact, whenever I used to, you know, talk a lot to people about this, the great rate of suicide among the youth. And it took me a while to understand that I could say to people that if you know someone who is suicidal, that all you really must get them to understand is that they can get beyond that particular moment, that particular night. And that if they can do that, there is a possibility of living to be a ripe old age, and having a really great time, a lot of the time. And this is something that does not occur to a suicidal person. A suicidal person always thinks that it's going to be just like this, you know, as far as the eye can see. And that is not true. And I'm not really crazy about Prozac. I'm more in favor of living the dark night if you can. I mean, if you can't, Prozac. But if you can, live it through, because that's where you meet the self that is the most difficult part of you. And that is where you become who you are. And it's really not to be missed, I think. So I was going back with these poems. Some of them are quite old. And this one is called Expect Nothing. And it speaks to that period when you are feeling very empty and as if you've used it all up, that you have nothing left. How many of you felt this? Oh my, not enough. Because actually it's a great place to be. It's like, you know, it's really like creation itself. You know, first there's nothing, and then there's everything. So I was writing in this poem, and then I was able to tell these students, you know, that this period is a time when you just are open, you're just empty, you're just waiting. But actually, you're not even waiting, you're just there. It's more like kind of hanging. Expect nothing. Live frugally on surprise. Become a stranger to need of pity. Or if compassion be freely given out, take only enough. Stop short of the urge to plead, then purge away the need. Wish for nothing larger than your own small heart, or greater than a star. Tame wild disappointment with caress unmoved and cold. Make of it a paka, a big coat for your soul. Discover the reason why so tiny human giant exists at all. So scared and so unwise, but expect nothing. Live frugally on surprise. And then I was telling them, and this is, it's important to tell the youth, really, all of these stations, you know. I have a feeling that with television especially, people don't really talk to each other nearly enough. And so young people often just have no idea, you know, that what they're feeling is ancient. I mean, it's exactly what everybody else felt, you know, two or three millennia ago. Be nobody's darling. And this is what would be really helpful to all of our children who are addicted to, for instance, Nikes. Or addicted to whatever these things are that seem to sweep the culture, so much so that the children seem to feel that if they're not going to have that, they don't exist, that they have nothing. Be nobody's darling. Be an outcast. Take the contradictions of your life and wrap around you like a shawl. To parry stones. To keep you warm. Watch the people succumb to madness with ample cheer. Let them look askance at you and you askance reply. Be an outcast. Be pleased to walk alone, uncool, or line the crowded riverbeds with other un-Nike'd fools. Make a merry gathering on the bank where thousands perished for the brave, hurt words they said. But be nobody's darling. Be an outcast, qualified to live among your dead. This school, when I was there, and I have to admit that I ran away from it when I was there. I was only able to stay 2 years because it was very bourgeois. And I was, you know, a farmer's daughter. And I knew that my education was really about not so much, you know, what I wore, is what I had to do when I got whatever learning I went there to get. So I wanted to convey something about the lure of diamonds and gold and how this can be such a trap. And also to just alert them to where these things come from, you know. I mean, there is such a disconnect between kind of what you have and where it came from. And this has meant devastation to most of the globe, actually, so that the upper half can have everything and the lower half can have almost nothing. So this is a poem I wrote when I was, I don't know where I was, I think maybe living in Mississippi. But I was looking at a photograph of African miners who were about to go into the mines to mine diamonds. And they were going into those mines perhaps for the rest of their lives because that's how the diamonds get up here. So, and at the same time, I was very aware of how in this culture, you know, a diamond is something that, you know, you are indoctrinated basically to think that you have to have. And unfortunately, it's actually tied to something so sacred as marriage because you have a wedding ring. I know you do. But anyway, the diamonds on Liz's bosom, the diamonds on Liz's bosom are not as bright as his eyes the morning they took him to work in the mines. The rubies in Nancy's jewel box, oh, how Ron loves red. Not as vivid as the despair on his children's frowns. Oh, those Africans. Everywhere you look, they're bleeding and crying. Crying and bleeding on some of the whitest necks in your town. I have a really good story to tell you about diamonds and this poem. About a month ago, someone wrote to me and said, do you know, I don't know whether she heard me read the poem or she read the poem herself, but she said it made me realize that I had some diamond earrings that my mother or grandmother or somebody gave me, and they've just been in this vault for, you know, however long. And she said, I've had them appraised, and they're $20,000. They're worth $20,000. And what do you think I can do with them? Because I'd really like to put them to use. What do you think of that? Don't know what to think, huh? Well, I didn't know what to think either, because I thought, well, you know, just do it. You don't need my blessing at all. If you have some diamonds lying around, anyway, this one is called We Alone. We alone can devalue gold by not caring if it falls or rises in the marketplace. Wherever there is gold, there is a chain, you know. And if your chain is gold, so much the worse for you. Feathers, shells, and C-shaped stones are all as rare. This could be our revolution, to love what is plentiful, to love what is plentiful as much as what is scarce. And then, because I was speaking to young people who are in college, but also this applies to all of us, because, you know, I was saying to them, I know that you're all madly in love with somebody, and you're probably just loving badly and wrongly, and, you know, it's probably a nightmare. It's so wonderful to get into this aunt role. And because, you know, the mothers don't do this. I mean, they have a whole other agenda. But I can be a general aunt to the youth and love it. Did you have mischievous aunts when you were growing up? The ones who just, you know, told you the real deal? Well, this is what your aunt, now just, you know, your aunt would have told you this. It's called Never Offer Your Heart to Someone Who Eats Hearts. From Auntie Alice. Never offer your heart to someone who eats hearts, who finds heart meat delicious, but not rare, who sucks the juices drop by drop, and bloody chin grins like a god. Never offer your heart to a heart gravy lover, your stewed, overseasoned heart consumed, he will sop up your grief with bread, and send it shuttling from side to side in his mouth like bubble gum. If you find yourself in love with a person who eats hearts, these things you must do. Freeze your heart immediately. Let him, next time he examines your chest, find your heart cold, flinty, and unappetizing. Refrain from kissing, lest he in revenge dampen the spark in your soul. And now sail away to Africa, where holy women await you on the shore, long having practiced the art of replacing hearts, replacing hearts with God. and song. Well, having not been permitted to go to the library when I was 6 and 7, I then decided to marry a man to whom to be married was illegal. So I wrote him this poem. And we were living in Mississippi at the time. And it was a crucible. It was one of those places where you grow up and you get to understand your country. And you get to know your history. And you get to know who your friends are. It's called While Love is Unfashionable. While love is unfashionable, let us live unfashionably. Seeing the world a complex ball in small hands. Love our blackest garment. Let us be poor in all but truth and courage handed down by the old spirits. Let us be intimate with ancestral ghosts and music of the undead. While love is dangerous, and love is always dangerous, let us walk bareheaded beside the great river. Let us gather blossoms under fire. Oh, I think I'll read you two more, one for you and one for Mother. And this one is for women, the women here, and for the men who love them. And basically also primarily too for the women who love themselves, which is sometimes the harder love. It's called A Woman Is Not a Potted Plant. A woman is not a potted plant, her roots bound to the confines of her house. A woman is not a potted plant, her leaves trimmed to the contours of her sex. A woman is not a potted plant, her branches espaliered against the fences of her race, her country, her mother, her man. Her train blossom turning this way and that to follow the sun of whoever feeds and waters her. A woman is wilderness unbounded, holding the future between each breath. Walking the earth only because she is free and not creeper vine or tree nor even honeysuckle or bee. And this I dedicate to all of you. And especially, you know, as we see the suffering of the earth, it's good to just remember how precious she is. We have a beautiful mother. Her hills are buffaloes. Her buffaloes, hills. We have a beautiful mother. Her oceans are wombs. Her wombs, oceans. We have a beautiful mother. Her teeth, the white stones at the edge of the water. The summer grasses, her plentiful hair. We have a beautiful mother. Her green lap, immense. Her brown embrace, eternal. And her blue body, everything we know.
You've been listening to a special presentation of An Hour with Alice Walker. Alice Walker was featured as part of the Free Library of Philadelphia's Rebuilding the Future series and was recorded at the Pennsylvania Convention Center. This program was made possible by the William Penn Foundation. The special on 91FM is produced by Robin Bloom. Our engineers were Al Banks, Chris Fraley, and Bob Purdick.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.